Sign up to The Economist for in-depth curated expert analysis of world events and topics ranging from business and culture to science and technology. You'll get the weekly digital edition, online-only articles, curated newsletters on politics, the markets, science, culture and China, and full access to The Economist Podcast Plus. The Economist is independent journalism for independent thinking. Go to economist.com and get your first month free.
It's a Wednesday on the Damage Report. Oh, you know, I'm not John Adarola, but it still is Big News Wednesday. That's correct. And the biggest news on a Big News Wednesday is that Trey Crowder is joining me on the program today. It's a very calm intro. It's an opening that we're making sure you guys are ready for, because the excitement could just boil over at any moment. We got the expertise. We got the wisdom. What's going on, Trey?
Not much. Yeah. It's not a rage filled morning this morning, as so many mornings are. So it may, you know, the calmer demeanor and everything I feel like is appropriate. Also, you know, it's November, whatnot. And I think like at least a few years ago, that meant you're supposed to grow a mustache. I'm sure people stopped doing that 10 years ago, but you know, I'm an old dad, so that's how late I am to things. But yeah, so I got
this. Is that the normal look? I'm trying to remember now. Is it, you have to shave down the beard part a little bit, or just accentuate?
Yeah, I'm keeping like the sort of like the stubble, but leaving this for a little bit and see what happens. But it's like, I don't get the like sort of like manly Tom Selleck one. I just look more hipstery, I think, generally, but still, we'll see how it goes.
We do know that trends and fashion styles do come back. So at some point, which I think maybe it already did, maybe 5 years ago or so,
right,
guys were wearing that, the Tom Selleck, purposefully. And it apparently appealed to some folks. So I guess it worked out for them. Maybe it's still around. Trey brings it back yet again. It's only been a few years. Let's make that happen.
Doing my best.
There's always something going on, you guys, though. Maybe a little bit of a celebratory morning as well, though, to you guys, because elections were last night in several, multiple, every damn state across the country. And things were passed. Things were rejected. Wins were made and losses happened as well. You can expect that, but Democrats feel like they came out on top in some of these very narrow races and narrow decisions based off of the voters here. Let's jump straight into some of these wins that went down. Democrats had a good election night on Tuesday, and they won just about every key contest. In Ohio, there was issues one and two, very generic names, but meaning a lot. Democrats won majorities in both chambers in Virginia, still leaving now the governor there on his own. They won the Supreme Court seat in Pennsylvania. More big news. Also, Kentucky Governor Andy Beshear, he also won his race. And although the governor candidate down in Mississippi for the Democratic side had lost, it was much different and closer than people maybe would have expected. So since I started talking about issues one and two in Ohio, let's go in backwards order and talk about issue two first, I believe, is the one. We'll start with this win about marijuana possession and growing even in the state of Ohio. Let's go here. Look at that map. So Ohio voted to legalize the possession and sale of marijuana. 57% of the folks who voted did so. I think that's pretty determined fact there. So what happens now that they voted this way, we'll see. Let's go to these details here from the Hill. This measure, which is known as issue two, would allow adults age 21 and older to possess up to 2.5 ounces of marijuana and grow up to 6 marijuana plants at home. Not sure how the monitoring process will be with that. It also establishes a 10% tax on marijuana sales, and this comes after the state legalized medical marijuana years prior in 2016. But legalization in Ohio is not guaranteed, even though the measure passed. Since it was a citizen-initiated measure, state law will allow the legislator to modify or repeal it. So since citizens, those folks who, folks who are elected are supposed to represent, since they initiated this entire process, they don't have the final say. I guess this is how America works. So many Republicans also in the legislature and Governor Mike DeWine, they expressed opposition to that legalization, of course. And so that whole fight has to find its way into hopefully the news and the way people will talk about it and actually understand how ridiculous it is that they're going to put some time and energy into undoing what the people of Ohio voted for. So just a pause there, because there's lots going on. I want your first thoughts on the marijuana legalization out there, because this is one of those things we just talked about a minute ago, Trey, off air, and how many of these races and these results I think, have a lot to do with the type of folks that are voting now, and maybe the folks who are in office or in power don't realize it. What are your thoughts, Bill?
Yeah, I think you're onto something there. I mean, I feel like the opposition to the marijuana legalization thing has been dwindling for a while. From my perspective, like, you don't really see much like reefer madness stuff anymore. And, you know, rightfully so, because I feel like at this point, even like old mammals have realized that it's like, it's not that bad. You know, it's not exactly bath salts or whatnot. And but there's still been opposition to it with lobbyists and whatnot, because, you know, I know a lot of, like, law enforcement lobbies and, you know, prisons and stuff like that. They stand to gain a lot by keeping marijuana illegal, which is one of the primary reasons it should be legalized. It's not just so people can, like, you know, get stoned and think about the moon or whatever. I mean, I'm for that, too. But like, we just don't need to be like locking people up or using, you know, jamming up the works of the justice system for weed stuff anymore. And I feel like people are generally coming around to that. But the important part that, you know, that you pointed out is, like, I mean, this is Ohio. The legislature there, they've demonstrated already that they have a pretty low opinion of democracy or the will of the people. They tried to, like, get the people to vote against their own ability to have voting power a few months ago. You know, they tried to, like, limit the power of democracy in their state already. I fully expect them to do whatever they can to just ignore the will of the people they ostensibly represent and try to, you know, mess this whole thing up anyway, because that's just chapter one of their playbook. So, you know, we'll see how it plays out. But I'm proud of the people of Ohio, though.
It shows, at least, because, you know, I always talk about how we overestimate the general intelligence and knowledge of American people, because they get duped and fooled into so many different thoughts that aren't real. But at least this is hopeful, at least, as people seeing through a lot of the weeds and things, ironically, that the smoke screens they put in front of people's faces about the reality of things and how they are. I think in states like California, you know, Nevada, wherever else it's been legalized already, it doesn't have to be right next door, but people understand it. We're much more, our societies know each other more than we used to. Those barriers have been broken down with the internet. So people may understand in Ohio and see neighboring states or states that aren't too far with legalization and go, so wait, what's wrong with this not being here again? Like, the narrative changes because we see how it hasn't destroyed the states that actually already have it. Next step, though, here in Ohio was also issue one. Maybe it should be called issue one because it was a little bit more important than the previous. But this was about abortion and access to that right as well, too. And that also won in the state as well, too. Look, 56.6% said yes on overturning this law that they put forward that was right after Roe v. Wade was passed by the Supreme, or overturned by the Supreme Court, and led them to then put forward their heartbeat bills and all that. More details from the Associated Press on that, because now that it's passed, the passage of issue one undoes that 2019 state law passed by Republicans that bans most abortions after around 6 weeks into pregnancy, with no exceptions for rape and incest. That law, also referred to as the heartbeat bill, is being held up in court. And it was one of roughly two dozen restrictions on abortion that the Ohio legislature had passed in recent years. Again, I don't know if the folks who are part of this thing that just got overturned because the voters don't want your garbage, if they're understanding, they may begin to relate that to you and understand that you don't represent them. I don't know if they're going to figure that part out yet. Democrats also held the Senate in Virginia, as I mentioned. Both of those, the legislatures down there, they apparently hold a very small majority, but a majority nonetheless. Governor Glenn Youngkin was all about passing his 15-week abortion ban in their last legislative session. And again, he's now out in the cold by himself. So Democrats now hold these majorities in both houses in that Virginia legislature for the first time since the Dobbs ruling. So things are going to change around here. Now, they hold the one-seat majorities in both houses, 21 out of the 40 in the Senate and 51 out of the 100 in the state house. So they've got that. So Virginia State Democratic Caucus Chair Mommy Locke had this to say after they'd won the majority. She says it's official. There'll be absolutely no abortion ban legislation sent to Glenn Youngkin's desk for the duration of his term in office, period, as we have thwarted MAGA Republicans' attempt to take control of our government and our bodies. And also, having won the Virginia House, they can also stop other parts of his agenda. Things grew even better for Democrats late in the night as the party won control of the state's House of Delegates from Republicans, which was a defeat for Youngkin. And now Democrats will have broad power to stop his agenda. Although, ironically, they also require support to get their own policies passed. So I guess Virginia's going to, nothing's going to be done for a while, because if the Democrats fall through with making sure they block all the things that Youngkin went on his agenda, and he also is probably bitter about this whole fight that'll be coming. I really wonder what's going to get passed that has much meaningful, I guess, thoughts behind it. So your thoughts on Virginia really fast, Trey?
Yeah, well, that last thing you said, I mean, you know, ain't that America? That's like the current state of our politics right now. It's just like, you know, obstructionist and stonewalling and everything that feels like nothing ever gets done. But I mean, they're, you know, the Republicans are the party of things not getting done. You know, all they don't want to, you know, give anything to anybody. They all just want to take things away. And I think people are, you know, waking up to that. A couple of things about in Virginia, as I understand it. First of all, Glenn Youngkin tried to frame all that. He tried to reframe the Republican stance on abortion there. He tried to like pitch them as being like sort of the centrist party when it comes to abortion, meaning like, oh, up to 15 weeks or whatever, we can do that. We can, you know, have exceptions. The liberals, they're the extremists on abortion. They want to, you know, they want to kill preschoolers under abortion laws or whatnot. Like, they just want to do whatever they want. You know, that's how he tried to frame it. And people clearly saw right through that, which is good. And then number two, there had been like talk about, you know, him jumping into the presidential race and the Republican primary and whatnot. And I feel like that's kind of dead in the water now, because this was sort of his like pet project right here. And he got soundly defeated. So we won't have to deal with any kind of Glenn Youngkin, you know, for the White House delusions, which I, for one, am in favor of. So, yeah, good night. Well, good night in Virginia.
There's still future White House bids, which I guess many people are concerned about. See this as a preview. Youngkin versus who's our guy out here in California? Because everybody knows he's speculating on it too. For Newsom. Newsom versus Youngkin. Damn. Mm-hmm. Might be something that happens in the future when things go back to the normal establishment folks running for office that look pretty much the same. Anyways, let's go on to more, because let's go over to now Kentucky. We're going through all these states. We're going to keep you guys updated on how things went down. So there's wins in Ohio and Virginia for Democrats. How about Kentucky? Incumbent Democratic Governor Andy Beshear. He somewhat narrowly defeated GOP State Attorney General Daniel Cameron in that hard-fought race that apparently cost tons of money. Let's look at the results. 52.5% for Andy Beshear as he defeated Cameron at 47.5% there. So as they fought for that, for control over that state, that also went this direction as well, too. NBC News points out that Beshear's reelection in a state President Biden lost by 26 percentage points in 2020 was due in part to the unique brand he has built in Kentucky. Separate from the national party, in his bid for a second term, he leveraged the popularity he built over the last 4 years, touting the state's economic progress and his response to natural disasters, including devastating floods. And it's something that Cenk always says, I'm not really sure many politicians do it this way, but when you have things you've done, tell people about it. Mm-hmm. And then also when you stop things that would have been devastating to whoever you're representing, tell people about it. And tell them about it more than once. Mention it, say it, go into detail, point out how it helps and why it helped, and that you're going to be doing the same thing rather than just like, I'm going to be doing this later. It's a bunch of promises that never have anything behind it. And that comes from both parties. But if you've done something positive for the people, not for rich folks only, then maybe you can tout that. He had the opportunity to do that, and I think it worked out for him a little bit there in Kentucky. A little bit closer to home for you there, but one more piece here. Beshear isn't able to be the shield, though, against this the abortion ban that they're going after. But his campaign did lean into that topic, when which even got his opponent to change his mind a little bit on it as well, too. And this is, again, part of that pressure coming from the way that people actually see reality. One more part from NBC News. Kentucky has a near total ban on abortion. It took effect last year after the Supreme Court overturned Roe v. Wade and eliminated that federal protection for the right to an abortion. So an ad from the Beshear campaign featured a young woman whose stepfather had raped her when she was 12. And after having defended the state's abortion ban as attorney general, Cameron did say that he would sign a bill adding exceptions for rape and incest if the legislature passed such a measure. So in order to try and get into office, Cameron was willing to lean back on some of his hard-nosed, never-say-die principles that they call principles as far as keeping folks access to abortion services. So in doing so, he's willing to switch if he thinks he can win. So how much does that have to do with his principles versus just trying to get into office? I'm glad that people, I think, saw through that a little bit. You go with the real deal versus someone who's just trying to catch up a little bit. Kentucky's a little bit closer to you, brother. How are you, at least where you're from? Yes. What thoughts there?
Oh yeah, no. As a Tennessean, I'm like absolutely fascinated by this situation in Kentucky. When it comes to their governor Andy Beshear, it's like I'm, you know, that meme of Squidward looking through the blinds at SpongeBob having a big old time outside. I feel like that all the time as a Tennessean as it pertains to this subject, because like I don't understand, like, you know, like you said, 26 points for Trump in the last election, home of Mitch McConnell, ruby red Kentucky. I know how red it is. I'm from right next door. And I'm just so jealous they managed to like somehow obtain a governor who isn't insane and makes sense and actually, you know, does stuff for the people and whatnot. Like, I want that for Tennessee. It gives me some hope. It's like, okay, I guess it is possible. He barely won last time. And like you said about what Jank always says about it, like, you know, what a novel concept. He like did a good job, like, and it did a good job for the people of the state of Kentucky. And they like recognize that, right? And it made a difference, which, you know, in some southern states, I don't know if I would have believed that to be the case before seeing something like this. So it is heartening. And also, yeah, his opponent, and it was kind of a masterclass too, that ad with the young girl who had been a victim and just clearly outlining like, look, this is a real person. This is what their policies really do mean. Like, this is what it would amount to. Okay. And like getting that across so successfully and forcing him to backpedal the way he did. Ironically, he was a former defensive back for Louisville, by the way. So he's accustomed to backpedaling. But yeah. And, you know, he was a big Trump backed guy, like the MAGA dude or whatever. And it's another repudiation of that whole philosophy, I'd like to think. So, yeah, I don't say this often, but go Kentucky. Love it.
The governor's race there as well, too, between Democrat Brandon Presley and the incumbent Republican governor there, you see Tate Reeves. Reeves did survive, though. That's the one downside, at least if you're rooting for many Democrats to change the way things are going. But it was a little closer than we could have imagined, though. Let's check out those results there, too, in that graphic, where Tate Reeves won with 51.8%. Compared to the 47, just about 47 from Brandon Presley there. So he eked that one out, which again says a lot more because, yo, this is Mississippi, right? Brandon Presley had a particular strategy. He couldn't tout any successes because obviously he wasn't in office, but he could say things that people have been saying that many Republicans just reject as wild, radical people. Mr. Presley traveled the state arguing for expanding Medicaid. Wow. And slashing the state's high grocery tax, which is one of the highest in the nation, saying he would bring relief to working class families. He focused heavily on mobilizing Black voters as well. But he also believed that he could peel away white centrists and Republicans who were drawn to his message. His message of doing something for them because they pay taxes. They vote for people who will represent them. It's so weird how we've gotten away from that concept. But if you go and tell people, yo, there's one part of this tells you it represents families and struggling families and helping middle class folks get on their feet or even maybe not be worrying about that next paycheck or maybe even that next medical bill. If you actually say you'll do something about it rather than just saying you represent them and I'm all for you, maybe they'll start to see that they're looking for results rather than just promises. He got close. A little bit more. He also relentlessly needled Mr. Reeves for a sprawling scandal in which millions of dollars in federal welfare funds had been siphoned away from supporting the state's poorest residents. You guys remember this down in Mississippi. The money was instead used for the pet projects of the wealthy and connected individuals, including a volleyball stadium at the University of Southern Mississippi, championed by one Brett Favre, a former professional football player. He played for the Packers forever before he went on to like the Vikings, but he's from Mississippi. So at the back end of that, this is what Presley said. We left no stone unturned, is what he told supporters on Tuesday and described the aggressive efforts in his campaign to crisscross the state. And he made stops in all 82 counties. He argued that the race had succeeded in bringing attention to urgent issues like Medicaid expansion. And he said, this is bigger than one man. We can lose this race tonight, recognizing good on the other side, which was the last little bit of my hopefulness on this, even in that loss. Look how close it was and look at the reasons why. So people may not want to come forward as far as conservatives and say, yo, we're looking to shut down Medicaid. We're looking to shut down your Social Security. And we're looking to make sure you have no access to many things that would be normally accessible to you because we brag about how we're these great Americans, greatest nation on the face of the earth. But our citizens are struggling with very simple, normal things. What's the benefit of being American again? Your last thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, you know, to keep with the sports analogies, you know, it's like you know, they say a moral victory, like when a team is, you know, generally big underdog or whatever, but ends up giving them all, everything they can handle, but still loses in the end. They call it a moral victory. Mississippi even coming this close, I feel like counts as such for me. And you're right. I mean, people have said all the time, like, what can Democrats do in these states, in these areas like this? And, you know, I've always thought and said, well, you know, stay away from the culture war stuff. You don't have to come in screaming about guns and all this type of thing. But it just, you know, focus on Democratic policies that would help these people or matter to these people directly, like stress that you want to do things for them. And, you know, I feel like with Kentucky and now Presley's campaign in Mississippi, there's some evidence to support that that could work or that people are open to that. And also we should say it's not without at least a little bit of funny business in Mississippi. There was a lot of weird voting things happening, but then Jackson, the 83% black capital of Mississippi, they ran out of ballots like 9 or 10 different times and couldn't get a response to that. And people were in line for hours and hours. And it's always in the same places and same types of communities that experience those problems. And I don't think it's accidental. And then they'll keep, you know, crying about voter fraud on the left and elections being stolen and whatnot while still, you know, suppressing votes wherever they can. So, but, you know,
basic strategy. I don't know how we keep falling for it to do the thing that you're claiming that your opponents are doing, so that anyone brings up the things that you're doing, that they'll then just say, oh, well, you guys are bringing it up just like we did. So it means our, we know the circular argument that they have going there. But again, hopefully people are seeing through it. So Republicans are already tired of playing with one Mike Johnson, the new Speaker of the House, because, yo, he's not doing everything that they wanted him to do. It's been only a couple weeks. So after sending to that speakership following a series of failed attempts, which we saw go back and forth, all the madness with McCarthy and then their potential replacements there, he's finally in the position. But also his full first legislative week, this guy's is going okay. He successfully navigated and survived the first full legislative week as Speaker of the House. He got through his first news conference with no gaffes or viral exchanges. He fielded a slew of questions from Senate Republicans on everything from foreign aid to government funding during a private meeting, and shepherded an Israel-only aid package through the lower chamber that united Republicans and divided Democrats. Scott Wong wrote this for NBC News, and I guess I would ask Scott a little closer, is that a successful week? Because apparently it's a successful week when you united Republicans, I guess is a good thing, behind this Israel-only aid package. But shouldn't it become a law or something that passes completely before it's a success? I would think so. And as we know, it's having issues everywhere else. So fellow House Republicans are predicting that his honeymoon period, by the way, with the rest of them, just might be coming to an end at some point. Because Tom Cole said, as a guy who's been married 52 years, everybody comes out of a honeymoon at some point. But I think what you saw over the last week is how much support he commands. Oh, so he still has support for now. So there's ugly fights that are potentially on the way. And I've said this when Gates, you know, even from January, when he was disrupting McCarthy's original ascent to the speakership, I was like, there's going to be some problems here. So there's more issues that are potentially coming behind the scenes. There are just 2 weeks left before another government shutdown. And Speaker Johnson will eventually have to govern by negotiating with Joe Biden and Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer, and risk infuriating the right wing of his party to keep the government open and deliver aid to Ukraine and Israel. Because again, as we know, there was all those promises that McCarthy apparently made and didn't follow through on, according to Gates and other folks that helped kick him out. He has to avoid those bombs. So before becoming Speaker, Johnson had joined fellow House conservatives in voting no on Ukraine aid packages. But in his meeting with senators privately, he made clear that he plans to take a different tone. Uh-oh, he's flip-flopping. Johnson told senators that border security and Ukraine are inextricably intertwined. That's according to John Cornyn. These are some of their border demands that are intertwined. Senate Republicans have released a sweeping set of U.S. border security proposals as a condition for sending more aid to Ukraine, laying out a draft plan to resume construction on parts of the U.S.-Mexico border wall, curtail humanitarian parole for people who cross into the United States, and make it more difficult for migrants to qualify for asylum. So they want to curtail humanitarian parole, and they want to also keep folks from being able to qualify for asylum. These are the demands to go and help folks in humanitarian crises, or as they see terrorist attacks on them, or also as another country invading Ukraine as well.
All those things are based on whether or not we can then limit other folks looking for asylum. The irony is just all over the place with that. So for this shift, though, these are reasons behind it. Speaker told senators that he needs to adjust his opposition to Ukraine aid now that he occupies the top job and has to reflect the views of his broader conference. That's what Ron Johnson said. Obviously, he's not related to him. The speaker also told senators that he prefers a short-term stopgap funding measure known as a continuing resolution or a CR, and it would keep the government funded through January 15th. So, Trey, here's the first couple of problems. We're going to get to Marjorie Taylor Greene and how she's saying more direct things than what's being insinuated by someone like Tom Cole. The problem now he's got is he's got to do the same thing that McCarthy was doing, which is keep the government open, work with other folks, because he's not the only person in charge. So the folks who thought that a new speaker means he's the new president or the new head of everything might be wrong.
Yeah, I don't know how it's going to end up any other way than it did with McCarthy, because like you said, I mean, he has to go and do the same thing. Like, they're going to get mad. The crazy contingent in his party is going to get furious with him for working with the Democrats. But like, that's the job. Like, he's going to have to do that, or it'll be a massive failure either way. He'll try to do it in the most diplomatic way he can muster. They'll hate him for it anyway. And then, you know, come after him with the pitchforks too, because those that particular, you know, faction of their party, like, can't be reasoned with. Like, it's not possible. They're completely unreasonable. And like you said, we're going to get to, like, Marjorie Taylor Greene's already mad at him. Like, it's going to get circusy again, even. But also, I just want to say real quick, I sort of take issue with the assessment earlier of the one journalist who said he had like a good first week, because they said he had no scandals and no gaffes and all that. Well, that's not entirely true, because I know that the internet dug up that video of him at a conference, like a church conference, admitting that him and his 17-year-old son monitor each other's porn consumption.
So, I didn't see that. Really?
You didn't see that? Yeah. Him and his 17-year-old son have an app installed that monitors their like consumption of objectionable material and send each other reports. So this dude gets like a notification on his phone for when his teenage son is breaking out the Jergens and Kleenex or whatever. Like, it's weird, right? And people, and it got, I saw it all over the internet, Reddit, Twitter, everywhere. Like, it got passed around a lot, and people were like, this dude is like, this is the, you know, the mild milquetoast variant that they put forth, that like this guy, because this guy's a crazy churcher, you know.
Did like you say they monitor each other?
Yeah, him and his son have an app on their all, not just their phone, all their devices that they own, and it monitors. Well, actually, it monitors all your activity completely. It's like a data mining, you know, gold mine. You know what I mean? Like, if they, that third party, it's wild that any conservative is giving a third party that access to literally all of their digital information for everyone in their family and doesn't even like realize it or care. But that aside, it monitors all your activity. If anything objectionable comes up, meaning porn, it sends a notification to your accountability partner, which in his case is his 17-year-old son. And it goes in both directions. So they're always notified. So like, this dude's hanging out with his teenage buddies and, you know, finds out that, you know, his dad's looking up MILF porn or whatever.
Yeah. So his dad, and what's objectionable? What's objectionable? I mean, it could be obviously porn, but then, dad, I saw something popped up and said you went to this place called Victoria's
Secret? Right.
Buying some women's laundry for mom?
It's a Christian software. So I would imagine their bar for objectionable is probably pretty low. I mean, you're probably right. So yeah, crazy. But either way, it's just super weird. And yeah, we're what, 2 weeks into his tenure? So, I mean, you know, just buckle up. It's going to be the same old stuff, I imagine.
Well, as we mentioned, there's one Republican in the House that's already voicing her concerns for Speaker Johnson. I'm not sure if she's going to monitor his questionable material that's on his devices, but she's definitely questioning his position and definitely what he is doing and said he's going to do. Let's go to some of that, because Marjorie Taylor Greene is not happy with Speaker Johnson. So she is one of two Republicans who voted no on Johnson's Israel aid package. And she doesn't fault him for putting that aid on the floor. But she expressed frustration with Johnson for failing to pass her resolution censuring Representative Rashida Tlaib for her criticism and protests of Israel. This sounds like it's a personal problem. Same as she's going to mention happened to Gates. More details. So in this interview with the Daily Caller, Marjorie Taylor Greene began with her irritation that the Republican rejection of her first attempt at censure of Tlaib. She said, we had 23 Republicans that voted with Democrats to table my resolution because they claimed they were protecting what she did to leave freedom of speech, which is jaw-dropping to me, because I wasn't silencing her freedom of speech. I wanted her censured for her speech. Okay, bro. A little bit more. Green went on to lay the blame at the feet of Johnson. Now this is where he gets involved for not whipping enough votes in support of her resolution. And she appeared to tease another speakership battle here. She says, well, he didn't help whip any votes for it. He told people to vote their conscience. Must be a horrible thing to say. So he was not supportive of it. And you know, in our conference, we had Matt Gaetz and seven other Republicans that declared red lines where any speaker that passes a CR or funds Ukraine war funding should be ousted. She says, she continues from that point. So my question is, we're about to have Speaker Johnson pass the CR. And he's talking about passing mega Ukraine funding, trying to pair it with the border security, pretending that the Biden administration is going to do anything to secure our borders. And he's already funded another foreign war, which is Israel. Where are the red lines? Do they still apply? Or are the eight willing to admit that it was really something personal the entire time? Damn, battle lines have been drawn. And by the way, Trey, yo, she's kind of right. Mm-hmm. Sorry to say it that way, but she's kind of right. As crazy it is, the things that they want and the reasons they got rid of McCarthy, Mike Johnson's going to have to do some of those same things, which we've already mentioned. But right. You can then point out, what's the difference then? It sounds like you just didn't like Kevin McCarthy, which, by the way, you can. A lot of people don't like Kevin McCarthy.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. I wouldn't look to them for like consistency or anything like that anyway. You know, it's not going to make them seem like less crazy to me if they end up being hypocritical on this one particular thing. You just add it onto the pile with them. But it'll be something, though, I think. I mean, it's like I said, like the party at large is like being held hostage by, you know, this tiny minority of its craziest members. And, you know, they've made that bed. Now they got to lay in it. And I just don't think it's going to get any more comfortable for them anytime soon, because it's just not in these people's nature. So if it's not this, it'll be something else before too long. I mean, maybe I'm wrong, but I'm pretty confident in that. So.
And again, you know, it was Matt Gaetz. It was one guy who was able to bring up this vote to oust McCarthy. And they're thinking about potentially changing that, because that madness did make them look very good. They're trying to see the number. They're still debating whether or not go to 7 or 8 or up to 100 people that would have to be on board. Something to make it a little bit more secure and stable there, which it's unstable. So how are they going to figure that out? One more story here, you guys, before we go to our next break, because this, I still don't know why, but it actually surprised me. The Supreme Court decision on guns with abusers. Let's go straight to this. On Tuesday, the Supreme Court, they appeared to uphold a 30-year federal statute disarming people who are subject to domestic violence protective orders. Wow, pretty good, but should be pretty standard. The law in question requires state and federal courts to submit restraining orders to the National Criminal Background Check System, which in turn blocks an attempted gun purchase. More than 77,000 gun sales have been denied under that law since 1998. Zaki Rahimi, a Texas drug dealer who was indicted for gun possession in violation of a restraining order obtained by his girlfriend, he's challenging the ban as lacking historical precedent. And a federal appeals court agreed with him and said that the law should be struck down. So it got up to the Supreme Court. And now Justices Kavanaugh and Amy Coney Barrett, they appear to show support for the law. Both suggested that even if there is not a historical twin for a law banning guns for people subject to domestic violence restraining orders, the dangerousness of a person has long been a basis for gun restrictions. 2 + 2 = 4. And the court's liberal justices, who have been highly critical of the history and tradition test for gun restrictions, they slammed the fact that the ban on guns for domestic abusers is even in question before them. They said, I'm a little troubled. We have a history and tradition test that requires a culling of the history where only some people's history counts. That's what Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson said about that as well, too. So that was on the side of at least it got through. And then some of those lib justices are like, why are we talking about this? The same way I was thinking. Who was against the decision that turned this down? For domestic violence abusers to go back and kill their partners. So Alito, Thomas, and Roberts. Let's go into their thoughts. We're told that there are situations in which a family court judge who has to act quickly and may not have any investigative resources faces a he, she said situation. And the judge just says, well, I'm going to issue an order like this against both the parties. That's what Samuel Alito said. Clarence Thomas, he worried that the implications of upholding the law might be too broad. He says, what if someone is considered not responsible for not storing their firearms properly? That's what he pointed out. And then Chief Justice John Roberts agreed with Thomas for some reason. And he said responsibility is a very broad concept. I mean, not taking your recycling to the curb on Thursdays. I mean, if it's a serious problem, it's irresponsible. Setting a bad example, you know, by yelling at a basketball game in a particular way. It seems to me that the problem with responsibility is that what seems irresponsible to some people might seem like, well, that's not a big deal to others. Maybe the folks who get shot with guns that are left out since Clarence Thomas brought up not storing your firearms properly, they might care about that irresponsibility. And if you get to take your garbage out on your Thursday, you have to wait till next Thursday to do it again. You have a little bit of a piling up of garbage. But from last I checked, if your garbage is piled up in your bin, the biggest problem you might have is maybe some raccoons and possum maybe getting into it. Not your daughter being killed. Just small differences in the irresponsibility levels that they're talking about. But if they can equate guns to being, yo, I forgot to check the mail, Dad, then I think they're trying to make sure this is minimized, despite the fact that so many people die at the hands of guns, specifically people who are out of their, safe parts of their brains when they fly off the handle and are angry at their partner and want to come back and shoot them. Just my thoughts, Trey.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, yelling at a basketball game feels a little different than, you know, beating your wife or whatnot. Like, it's crazy. It's just wild. Point to even try to make publicly as a Supreme Court justice, you would hope. This is why the whole gun debate is so frustrating, is because, like, this is where the bar is for, you know, one side of the debate. You know what I mean? Like, even this, like a lot of these justices, and like you said, it's wild to me. It's like, it's controversial whether or not domestic abusers should be armed. Like, we already know they're dangerous. You don't want people to be armed and dangerous, right? Like, we should take the armed part away if we can, at the very least. Like, this is up for debate, but it is because of, like, you know, they immediately get into some version of the, like, slippery slope argument or whatever. We got to look at the implications. It's like, no, not really. No, you don't, because the implications for not doing this are far graver. More people will be shot. More people who are already victims will be shot to death if you strike this down. And then they say, like, there's no historical precedent for it, and that's why you can't do it. Well, yeah, domestic abuse used to be legal and encouraged for like 200 years. You know what I mean? Of course there's not a historic and traditional precedent for a law like specifically this one. It's just so ridiculous. It's like, I was never a hardcore gun control guy, like used to be. Now I have kids in school and I'm desperate for us to do something about it. Mm-hmm. But that's what I'm saying. You can't even start the conversation because it's like nothing. They give no ground, the hardcore gun nuts. It's like, it doesn't matter how reasonable it sounds to your average person. They're like, no, that's completely untenable. And that's why it's, you know, one of the more frustrating issues we have. That and the fact that it results in so many people dying, you know, so the stakes are so high and they still, you know, stand their ground, for lack of a better phrase.
Yeah, I like to point out sometimes when they say, like, you know what, 77,000 guns were taken away from potential domestic abusers since 98 or under that law. How many people are alive today that would not have been alive from those 77,000 guns that potentially got in the hands of domestic abusers? And maybe many of those domestic abusers would not have used their guns on their partners, but many would have.
Right.
Because we know that's what happens. So it's not like it's outside of the normalcy of reality. It happens, and there's big numbers behind it. So it's a matter of whether or not you care enough to save those lives, or at least try to save those lives. Because the assumption is, oh my God, if you take the gun away from the guy who's a potential abuser, he might get hurt. Someone might run up on him and he needs his gun. What about the person who was already been threatened? Just saying.
Apologize for any embarrassment caused by my private and personal life. I have nothing to be ashamed of. A lot of things that were said were taken out of context.
That was Bubba Copeland. That was his last sermon to his congregation, and apologies for his personal life that has since come to surface. And a few days later, he ended his life there. He was exposed for having an alternate identity online, where he would dress in women's clothing and have a different identity, name, and enjoyed himself, lived his actual life for a bit. And after that then came forward, he couldn't take, I guess, the embarrassment and the ridicule that was coming his way. So let's go to details of what is that happened afterwards. His death came 2 days after the publication 1819 News. They published an article about his secret life. That's despite him asking them not to, for the sake of his family and his role as a pastor at a church in Phoenix City, which, by the way, also this small town that he was the mayor of, Smith Station, Alabama. He's also was well known and liked apparently in the community. A little bit more, though. Copeland told that outlet that he started role playing at a young age to relieve stress and asked that pictures of him not be published. After those photos were posted to the website, Copeland apologized to his congregation, as we saw there, for any embarrassment that his private and personal life caused them. That right-wing outlet, which is edited by Breitbart contributor Jeff Poor, they published an initial story last Wednesday alleging showing social media accounts operated by Copeland in which he identified as a transgender woman and shared images of himself in women's underwear. The outlet published another story on the day of his death alleging that he wrote violent fiction and posted photographs online of people in his local community without their consent. Pause. So we're going to get the details of that, things he wrote and all that in the back end. Hopefully we can get this really fast. But first off, on the front end of this here, after the day of his death, the response is, well, look what else he did. Let's go into detail of what else he did. But is it basically celebrating his death? We'll see. A little bit more. Phoenix City School Superintendent Larry DiChiara told NBC News Monday that he decided to get in touch with Copeland after seeing people just relentlessly attacking him after that 1819 News started publishing its pieces. Authorities say a welfare check was called into the sheriff's office on Friday, and two deputies found him driving on a country road. The deputies tried to get him to pull over around 10 minutes before Copeland got out of his car and took his own life in front of them. He added that law enforcement had no idea Copeland would do that. It's just tragic all the way around. More of what some of those folks said. So again, this is a Republican down in Alabama, mayor of this city, pastor of a church, preaching to his congregation. So you can imagine what maybe his politics were. This is what they were. In April of 2022, the same month that Alabama Governor Kay Ivey signed into law a bill barring school children from using bathrooms consistent with their gender identity, Copeland endorsed Ivey's reelection. In campaign literature during his own reelection in 2020, Copeland used a photo of himself with Donald Trump, with the then president visiting Alabama after a series of deadly tornadoes in 2019. And Copeland never openly criticized his state's Republican-led legislative assault on trans rights, such as making it a felony for doctors to give people under the age of 19 gender-affirming care and passing Alabama's own version of Florida's Don't Say Gay law, which forbade classroom discussions of sexual orientation or gender identity with students in the fifth grade and under. So people were upset about this whole thing as well. We don't have to get to their comments there on the front end, but that's where I think we see a little bit of this collision of logic here, at least specifically with Bubba Copeland, because he supported all the things that went against who he is or was, and other folks that struggle with this as well, which is where maybe some of the ridicule and condemnation came from once all this came forward. But then once he ends his life, the sympathy just didn't seem really be there from those same folks. First thoughts here, Trey, before we get to more.
Yeah, I mean, like you said at the end there, like, I mean, that's the part that, you know, this dude was a pillar of his community in a small town for a long time. I'm from a small town. I know how that works. I guarantee he was much beloved reportedly and everything. And then as soon as all this stuff comes out, everything else he'd ever done his whole life didn't matter to these people. They turned on him in a heartbeat. It bullied him into literally killing himself. And I guarantee you, they have, most of them probably have no remorse over it. They're just probably saying that, like, you know, it's a shame he lost his battle with the devil. The devil right. clearly got to him and ended up winning out in the end. It's like, no, it wasn't the devil. It was y'all. It was y'all and your, you know, draconian and needlessly hateful ideology that, you know, forced this guy to do this in the end. Like, he wouldn't, none of this needed or had to have happened. It's just because of, you know, the outmoded philosophies that they still enact down there, the type of stuff that drove me, you know, crazy my whole life. So I do feel bad for him. And as far, I don't know, maybe the other stuff they said, maybe it was bad. We don't have the full context, but like I said, he writes violent fiction. I write violent fiction. I've written scripts with people getting shot and stuff in it. Like, who cares? And number two, so you take posted pictures online of people without their permission. That's pretty broad too. I was just at a NASCAR race on Sunday and I took a picture of like my view. And I realized after I posted it to my Twitter with all my followers and stuff, you could see like 8 or 9 other people in it. And in my head, I was like, should I not have done that? Is that not cool? I didn't get these people, you know, like that right. can mean a lot of things, but they do this all the time, just trying to paint him in the worst light possible. you know, to sort of, I guess, justify the fact that, like, it's okay that he killed himself because he was a secret, you know, queer person or whatever. I don't know.
And this is the thing. Maybe you have issues with the way he supported many of the folks and laws that went against folks' rights that he could probably relate to. But the thing is this threw me off. Let's get straight to this aspect of it, because Matt Walsh, host of his own show, I believe on the Daily Caller's network, I believe. Forgive me if I'm wrong on that. I always forget which is which. People are blaming 1819 News, of course, for what he pushed back on was the outing of Bubba Copeland. So Matt Walsh had issues with the fact that they were pushing against this one outlet, because apparently he wants it to be known so that they can ridicule and eventually push someone to suicide. But let's watch the first little bit of what Matt Walsh had to say in support of that site.
It's important to underscore that he uploaded all this material voluntarily to the internet while he was serving as mayor. And since everything that a public official uploads to the internet is newsworthy, especially when it's perverted and depraved, that's an important fact to highlight. For one thing, Bubba Copeland was a deeply troubled man. Also, Copeland's last act was a choice that he made, a wrong choice, but a choice all the same. Now, that may seem too obvious to even say, but we tend to speak in euphemisms about these kinds of situations, and all of the euphemisms are carefully crafted to minimize or erase any degree of personal responsibility whatsoever. That's why the response to Copeland's death from pretty much everyone on the left who has commented on it, from activists on social media to elected officials to corporate media outlets, has been so depraved, but also so predictable. In our culture, which has long jettisoned any sense of objective truth or morality, Copeland is not seen as accountable for any of this. Instead, pretty much without exception, the left is blaming conservatives for this man's death. In particular, a small conservative news outlet in Alabama called 1819 News.
So he has issue with them being blamed for it. And he also went longer about how he wasn't actually outed because he posted this stuff online where it could be found and people could come see and talk about it. So it wasn't necessarily outing something he kept secret. It was just exposing him further to broad and more radical ridicule and hatred. Let's keep it real. So again, I get the collisions in his logic being Bubba Copeland's and actually what he went forward versus who he was. But at the same time, does that cause you to go after someone until they do what he then did? And do you feel better afterwards? Even if you thought it wasn't going to happen, you would think afterwards, you'd say, maybe I should rethink my approach, because I didn't realize, as the police said, that he would do such a thing. If you didn't, then maybe you have some remorse for this guy's life being lost, again, because of who he was. And they'll, of course, always push it off to the side. One more part here before we get out of here, because I want to play this last side, you guys. Sot 5, because this is where Matt Walsh actually does describe what is that was in some of the writings that he did. And I think there's an explanation behind it that a lot of times comes right back to our own society. Let's go to Sot 5 first, you guys.
Copeland also posted a lot of sexual content and encouraged others to take cross-sex hormones, even though by his own admission, he apparently wasn't taking them himself. Additional reporting from Redux revealed that Copeland had also allegedly posted several disturbing short stories and erotica online, including one piece in which he fantasized about killing a local constituent who runs a small business and assuming her identity as a woman. To be clear, Copeland used the identity of an actual constituent in this story. It was not a fictional person. He was openly fantasizing about killing a female constituent and taking her identity. This is the mayor of the town, just to emphasize.
So Trey, I have thoughts on that aspect of it, but there's the details if you want to have your response to that.
I mean, yeah, that makes it sound worse. Don't get me wrong, especially using a lady's actual identity. But, you know, it all comes back to like the intense repression that he, you know, faced because of his community and everything for years. So I still lay the blame firmly at the feet of the Lord, frankly, or, you know, the Lord's followers. Yep. Smith Station, Alabama, as it were. But yeah, you see my stuff down there, Trey Crowder. Go to TreyCrowder.com, by the way, guys. Check out my tour dates. Come and see me. I'll be in Chicago on Sunday. Bunch of other places coming up. So
traveling, guys. Sorry, I didn't get to that on the top end.
That's all right.
Catch up with you, brother. Again, but that was exactly my thought. Our society then came after him because of that. He knew that. That's why he was hiding many aspects of who he was. And even in writing something like this, this should be an indication that if someone's fantasizing about taking another person's place in society, and it would be through violent means like what it was written about, that sounds desperate. Right. Sounds extremely desperate. Why is he desperate? Is he desperate just because Satan got in his head, or is he desperate because the society he's surrounded with is so hateful? Since we're talking hate and devil and all that stuff, just like God works in mysterious ways, sometimes the devil uses people to get to his his agenda passed. And if you're part of those folks who were part of a hateful campaign that got the end of what this devil wanted, which was Bubba Copeland's life, don't you feel like you're working for the devil? Just saying, since it's so satanic, you were part of this push. So yes, maybe could have been some manifestos behind him who could have become like one of these shooters that kills people because of some detachment from society or pressure or hatred that they're feeling. They still become violent. Whatever reason it is, it's bad. And whatever reason he wrote what he wrote, it's from bad places and maybe the way society affected him. I went way over. Thank you guys really fast. We're going to go to this the aftermath in a minute. And we got a few more stories, light it up just a little bit, as devastating as that was. But we'll catch you guys on the back end. So grab firmly to those ass cheeks. The last time, one more ass cheek grab, and we'll be back in a minute.
Thanks for listening to the full episode of The Damage Report. Support our work, listen ad-free, access members-only bonus content, and more by subscribing to Apple Podcasts at apple.co/TYT. I'm your host, John Adirola. I'll see you soon.